Before we kick off the show, if you're a fan of History Hack, please do what you can to support the show. We completely get that not everyone is able or willing to dig into their pockets. Times are hard, but by dropping a like, subscribing on Twitter and YouTube, and importantly, leaving a review wherever you get your podcasts, you can help the program grow and reach more people. If you're interested in becoming a supporter, go to patreon.com/historyhack, where you'll find perks from secret Facebook groups to early release material. If you just want to leave us a one-off tip, go to ko-fi.com/historyhack. The links are in the description. And whatever form your kind support takes, know that we are massively grateful. Enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to another episode of History Hack. It's very exciting today because we are covering, and it bugs me that we don't cover it more, Zach, so I'm very impressed you've gone off and found this. We're covering Native American history today. Tell us how.
Well, you do sometimes shout at me when I don't produce quite what you're after, so I figured I'd better kind of deal with this one and make sure that we did do some decent Native American history. And I'm delighted to say we're joined by Greg Smithers. Greg is a professor of American history at Virginia Commonwealth University and is a British Academy Global Professor at Hull University, so very distinguished CV. He researches on Cherokee and Southeastern Indigenous history, as well as gender, sexuality, racial and environmental history. He's the author of Native Southerners, Indigenous History from Origins to Removal, The Cherokee Diaspora, An Indigenous History of Migration, Resettlement and Identity. And today we're going to be talking about his latest book, Reclaiming Two Spirits, Sexuality, Spiritual Renewal and Sovereignty in Native America. Greg, I'm a bit out of breath after that incredible CV. How are you doing? Welcome to History Hack.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
This is brilliant. Right, let's start with the title and explaining what that means to people. So two-spirit, what is meant by that term and what's the history behind it?
Okay, so it's a fairly recent history we're talking about. But before I get into that, I should say that the title actually comes from Native people themselves. So I spent a lot of time talking with Native community members, with elders about their culture, their history, what is acceptable for historians to make public, and other material that ethically I should not publish because the public doesn't necessarily have a right to hear that information. And they may, as anthropologists and historians did for decades and perhaps centuries, get information out of context and misrepresent Native knowledge and tradition and ceremony. So I was very careful in writing this book to make sure that I spoke with elders and got their permission and sort of their approval to go ahead with this. And so the title actually comes, I mean, this is what Native people who are two-spirit are doing. They're reclaiming tradition, they're reclaiming knowledge, and they're reclaiming their identities. And so the phrase two-spirit comes out of a gathering that occurred of what was then called lesbian, gay, bisexual, and trans Indians in 1990. It was the third international gathering, and the gathering occurred just outside of Winnipeg, Manitoba, in Canada. And if you cast your mind back to this period, this is the era of the AIDS pandemic. HIV/AIDS was tearing a swath through communities of color, in particular in North America. And so there was an awful lot of external stress in addition to people trying to reclaim culture and knowledge. And so at this third gathering, people got together. It was about 100 people at a campsite just outside of Winnipeg. And people brought their tents and their teepees and food. It was a alcohol and drug-free event that was very important to people. And it continues to be important to two-spirit people. And they sat around and they did what Native people have done for centuries. And they talked and debated and discussed and they laughed and cried and sang and they held each other. And out of this, they decided that two-spirit would be the ideal nomenclature, the ideal label for for who they were. You know, gay and lesbian and bisexual, these Western terms didn't quite capture it. I mean, that spoke about sexuality. And yes, sexuality was important to Two-Spirit people, but it didn't quite capture the completeness and the connection to culture that people were looking for. And so this term Two-Spirit is an English translation of an Algonquin term, Nijmanaduog. And Nijmanaduog basically means a person with male and female spirits in a single person. And although terms for Two-Spirit people are specific, tribally specific, this as an umbrella term seemed to be a good fit. The delegates at that 1990 gathering agreed, because it was a term that both native, non-gay, lesbian, bisexual, trans people could get, and also non-native people, period, could grasp onto and understand. And so as this umbrella, it then provided a space to engage in what might be called international diplomacy with the non-Indigenous LGBTQ community and the broader American community. And then from within, you know, with that umbrella sort of encompassing this very diverse group of people, people could then have the space to reclaim and to rearticulate specific traditions specific and knowledge specific to their communities.
So looking at the history behind this then, and what's been written before, how much has previously been written about what would, before the term Two-Spirit was brought into the mainstream, what we would have termed LGBTQ members of the Native American community, and how has their history been characterized generally?
Yeah, and that's a great point. That's a great question, because the reason that this umbrella term was deemed to be necessary is that the scholarly community and the non-Indigenous community across North America generally referred to lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender Indians at the time in the 1980s and 1990s by a very old and offensive term. The term was badash, which is derived from an old Persian term, which basically means a slave or a kept boy. It was a term of submission. It was a term that was used, it was still used in the 1980s and the early 1990s in anthropological scholarship. Historians very rarely touch this topic, largely because of the archival silences, and historians, being a very positivistic bunch that we are, we like stuff to be written down, right? And so if it's not written down somewhere, then it's very difficult for us to talk about. So that was a problem for historians. For literary scholars, they had started writing about this in the 1980s and 1990s, but they were using that old offensive language of badash. And in addition to sort of, I don't know, mindlessly perhaps, or passively, probably a better way to put it, of repeating some of the language that was used in archival texts that survived, right? So sodomites, hermaphrodites, you know, these types of offensive labels that said more about Europeans and what they thought they saw and what they misunderstood than it said about Native knowledge and culture. So in terms of what was written then, there was a lot of misinformation out there. Now, I should point out that in the 1980s, there were a few scholars who began to re-engage with this subject. And that was quite revolutionary at the time, because this is a topic that hadn't been touched really since anthropologists were doing field work in the late 19th and early 20th century. Those anthropologists at places like UC Berkeley were reifying those older terms like badash in some of their work. And I talk about them in the book. So in the 1980s and 1990s, there were a new group of anthropologists who were beginning to look for ways to get around these offensive labels. And that work ultimately led to the movement that I talked about in terms of Two-Spirit people saying, hold on a minute, we've got to take control of this narrative ourselves. Because they were engaging with the anthropologists in the 80s and 90s, but Two-Spirit people were still seeing Western scholars controlling, driving the narrative. And Western scholars were imposing labels like Amazon onto Two-Spirit women, for example. And that just didn't quite fit. It just seemed culturally inappropriate, which is why we get Two-Spirit people driving the narrative by the 1990s. And it has to be said that it's a lot of literary writing, a lot of poetry, a lot of literary analysis, and a lot of art in terms of performative art, dance, painting, and modern technologies over the last generation to not only recapture and re-engage with older traditions, but also to tell new stories, which, I mean, we're talking about living cultures here, and that's what Two-Spirit people, as I talk about in the book, are doing. They're giving new life and adding new chapters, if you will, to what it means to be Two-Spirit in the 21st century. So, I mean, that's a long-winded way of saying that I sort of came in on the scene and decided that in conversations with some of my friends who were Two-Spirited, that there was really, and they were telling me that there's really no history that adequately deals with who we are within the context of American colonialism, but more specifically and more importantly within Native communities. And so in terms of a narrative that's written, I hope that's accessible and engaging for people, there's very few stories like this out there. In terms of book length treatments, it's largely scholarly stuff. And so very dense, very jargonistic. I've tried to write something that's different. So the book stands out in that respect.
I think we should talk more generally about the history of sexuality and Native Americans, because it's such an interesting topic. So prior to the arrival of the Spanish in the Americas, how did Native Americans think about sexuality, and how did that change in the 16th century?
It's difficult to answer. I mean, it's hard to know what's going on inside people's heads and what's driving their urges. But it does seem from the archaeological evidence that has survived that Native people throughout the Americas had a healthy attitude and respect for sexual expression. It didn't necessarily fall along the heteronormative lines that we associate with in Western culture. It was perfectly acceptable in cultures throughout the Americas for people to have sexual partners across what we understand today as male and female, the male and female gender binary. And that was represented. That was represented in the crafts and the pottery, the effigy work that was done in terms of architecture and mound construction. And so that healthy respect for human expression, we see that in the archaeological record, and we see it surviving through the oral histories. One of the interesting things I found in doing this is that Europeans tried very hard. I mean, you got to remember that the Spanish came along, and it's not just conquistadors, it's missionaries also. And they burned text. I mean, we're having a debate in the United States right now about censorship and what is pornography and what should be available to college and school-age children. Missionaries were taking that decision out of our hands, really, in the 1600s. And they were burning Mayan and Aztec codices and documents that would have given us far deeper insight into human emotion, human sexuality, human relationships. And so we've had to rely extensively on that oral record, simply because a lot of the empirical written documentation that historians like was destroyed. And there are numerous instances. We can go through the centuries and talk about that. I mean, during the Revolutionary War, for example, Cherokee towns in southern Appalachia were burned and destroyed. And with that were burned and destroyed documents that gave insights into the political, social, and cultural life of Cherokee people. And in fact, some of the documents that were then stolen and taken by Continental soldiers become some of the first documents in the Library of Congress. Right. So there's stories of destruction and theft here that are woven into the story of Two-Spirit sexuality and gender construction. And I say all of this because what is really quite extraordinary, and I think what makes this story epic in terms of a story of not only survival, but of resilience and innovation and just extraordinary will and energy, is the way in which Native peoples were able to hold on to those traditions, to recognize that colonialism at various times throughout the 18th, 19th, 20th, into the 21st century was such an oppressive force that sometimes we need to take these things inward. And as I point out in the book, one of the things that people understand is that if white Americans understood what was really going on in Indian communities, they probably would have tried even harder to wipe them out, because that knowledge was such a challenge to heteronormative male, female, heterosexual relationships. And so the fact that Native people are able to nurture in private those traditions, the stories, and the practices of fluid gender and sexual relationships, to me is quite a triumphant story set against a backdrop of extraordinary oppression and violence at times.
There is a whole podcast really to be done, isn't there, on the survival of Native American traditions. And much though I'm tempted to dive into that, I think we'll probably save that for another day. But I do want to touch on something that's related to what you were just saying there, which is about European attitudes and reactions towards Native American gender identities and constructions. You've written about their fixation with manly women and feminine men. Talk us through how that works from the European perspective and what they're trying to refer to.
So Europeans, and particularly the English, sorry guys, were really put off by Native American people seemingly changing their identity, right? Clothing, body adornments, whether it's paint, whether it's jewelry, whether it was the way people wore their hair, a whole, you know, it runs the gamut of physical manipulation and subterfuge, as the English saw it. And they saw this as an external marker of how Native people were not to be trusted, right? They're up to no good, they're shifty and sneaky. They say one thing, they still got both sides of their mouth, basically, is the implication here, right? And so if you've got a culture, if you're dealing with a culture and you're trying to establish diplomatic relations and trade relations with a Native group, and some of their leaders, their knowledge keepers, are changing their physical appearance, seemingly changing their identities, then how can you trust them, right? If they've got 10, 11, 12 different words to describe their gendered identity, who are these people? I mean, this really threw Europeans through a loop. You know, this was a time when Europeans are really trying very hard through the law, through politics, through trade, to really nail down a lot of the categories that define the modern world in the 19th and 20th centuries. Right? It's all being made during the 17th, 18th century. And Europeans bring all those concerns with them. Right? These are sort of mechanisms to socially order and politically structure colonial societies. And in fact, it's deemed even more important in a colonial space that is seemingly wild and lawless. And so whether we're talking about Italians, whether we're talking about the French, the Spanish, but particularly the English were really, really concerned, as I mentioned, about the manipulation of physical appearance. And as I said, they're concerned about that because they're worried about whether they can trust people that they're dealing with. But the English are also really concerned that the behaviors that they assume they're seeing might bleed into the nascent colonial communities and influence the way colonizers behave with each other. And that remains a concern throughout the 17th and 18th centuries. In fact, even into the 19th century and some of the captive narratives that emerged during that century. So control, trying to get some sort of control over how Native people comport themselves was part of the knowledge conquest, was part of the colonial endeavor to acquire that information and then stamp out, if necessary, the types of gendered behaviors, sexual activity that crossed the heterosexual line. And that's why you see such intense violence from the moment the Spanish arrive all the way through to the English and Americans. I mean, I talk about George Catlin, the famous painter, who wishes for the tradition of the bidash, as he calls it, to be extinguished forever so that there's no knowledge of it, right? There's sort of this desire for a type of cultural genocide that continues into the 19th century. And that's a harbinger back to an era when European colonizers were targeting the people we call today Two-Spirit because they recognized that they were the keys, they were the links and the knowledge keepers. And if they eliminate those people from Native communities, then they eliminate all knowledge of these traditions. And so that's why Two-Spirit people were so often targeted in the history that I narrate.
So we're talking about Western Europeans coming over and trying to obliterate traditions that they find. How do Native Americans respond to this?
Well, they respond in a number of different ways. One of the things I think it's important for listeners to recognize is Native people didn't just submit to colonialism. Native people had a number of different strategies for negotiating with and dealing with colonizers from all different European backgrounds. And for the most part, that meant trying to incorporate this foreign knowledge and these foreign systems into their own systems of kinship and politics and culture and so on. And that really continued. I mean, in some ways that still continues today. Native people are trying to find the space in the 21st century to continue their traditions and their knowledge and their ceremonies while seeming to use the political traditions and language of the American Republic. Right, so that's nothing new. Native people have been doing that for a long time, and that applies to trade as well as politics and other facets of life. So that's one area in which Native people tried to resist, was to incorporate ideas and knowledge and structures on their own terms. Another was to physically resist, and there are a number of Two-Spirit people throughout the book, from the Pacific coast to the Atlantic coast, that I talk about, who do engage in armed resistance. This is the most obvious form of resistance. It's the type of resistance that my students like to hear about most, of Native people taking up arms and sticking it to the European colonizers. And there is some evidence of that, of Native people resisting European and Anglo-American intrusions and invasions into their homelands. And with that, an effort to remake their culture and their knowledge systems. But there are other forms of resistance too. And I think silence in this case is a resistance, a form of resistance for Native people and particularly for Two-Spirit people. Because what they had to do is they had to keep those traditions in house and that was, thank God they did, because what we see developing in the late 20th century as gay and lesbian Indians in the 1970s, as they then called themselves, was searching for a sense of identity, a sense of place in the world, but particularly in the native world, in Indian country. They went back to the elders, and the elders, who were not necessarily Two-Spirit themselves, had held on to these stories, had held on to the knowledge, and were able to pass it on and share it with those gay and lesbian Indian leaders in the 1970s and early 1980s, who are now Two-Spirit elders in the 21st century. And they've taken that knowledge, and they're able to then tell those stories to younger Two-Spirited people today. And I think for me, in writing the book and in telling a number of those stories, that is the most important lesson, I think, is just how determined and resilient Native communities are to hold on to tradition and to renew knowledge traditions so that these are living traditions we're talking about, so that they still have meaning in 2021, we're in 2022 now, sorry.
it's okay, COVID's done that to everyone.
I know, I've lost a year
somewhere.
But yeah, it still has meaning in 2022 as much as it did in 1722 for people, right? So that, I mean, what a gift. And what an incredible story for all the tales, and they are many, of violence and racism and homophobia and all of that stuff. I still, at the end of the day, see this as a really positive and uplifting story, a story of Indigenous power. And that's why, you know, that word reclaiming is at the beginning of the title, because, I mean, it is a story of just incredible resilience and strength and an ability to adapt and innovate and take the traces of old stories and old knowledge and then to give them new life and meaning in the 21st century. I think I just am blown away by that. I think it's incredible.
Can I talk and take this sort of back slightly to something you were talking about earlier when you were explaining to us about European attitudes and this desire to eradicate these whole notions of two spirits? Is religion a factor in all of that? Can you sort of help us unpick, you know, to what extent is, particularly for the Spanish Catholicism, Protestantism, for the British? How does that play into all this?
Some tedious connotations, hasn't there, with people's religious ideas that they bring with them? There's baggage.
There is baggage, yes. And I'm afraid so. The short answer is yes. Mm. And when I give what's funny is when I give talks in front of Indigenous groups, that's all I really need to say. Yes. they get it. I mean, you know, last year, at the end of last year, for example, we there was a discussion in Canada, the United States, and it's still going on, talking about boarding schools. And a lot of those boarding schools, you know, were driven by this sort of Christian desire to remake Native kids in the image of good little white Christian boys and girls. And I talk a little bit about that in the book, about how the boarding schools were used and targeted children we would identify today as Two-Spirit, and how Native kids, when they first got to those boarding schools, responded with just shock and fear at how those Two-Spirit kids were being treated. But yeah, I mean, this is I talk at great length about this in the book, about the developing notions, the political applications, I should say, of particularly Catholicism during the early years of North American or colonialism in general in the Americas. Because the sort of the legal and political applications of Christianity and as that applied to gendered and sexual norms wasn't uniform across Europe in the early modern period. There were differences in legal interpretation and application of the law. But one of the things that I think colonization does is it heightens the sense, from a European perspective, it heightens the sense of urgency, of the need to do something in a world that seems utterly chaotic. And particularly the missionaries and the friars who travel to the Americas travel with a really zealous desire to remake native bodies and native souls, to save their souls, but certainly to, part of that is to remake their bodies and what they do with their bodies. And as a result, what we see is, you know, Spanish friars burning Mayan and Aztec texts, but also, you know, stealing children, abducting children who look as though they are being, in the minds of missionaries, being groomed for a life as someone who will be a two-spirited person. And so Christianity in general plays a major role in this, but particularly Catholicism, French and Spanish Catholicism have left us with a lot of written documentation, which I go into in the book. But you mentioned Protestantism, and yeah, I mean, you know, it is the case that English Protestants did come to the Americas with this sort of idea of where people should fit into the world. And if you think about, you know, Puritans and Pilgrims, for example, in New England, they travel with some very rigid ideas about where men and women should fit into the world. And they defined very early in their laws in the New England colonies, what was acceptable and not acceptable in terms of sexual expression. And same-sex expression was not necessarily something that was acceptable. They saw that as akin to a type of bestiality, that, I mean, it was part of sodomy laws throughout New England. So there is this bleeding together of law, politics, and Christianity in the colonies, in North American colonies. And I think that shouldn't be something that necessarily surprises people, because in the early modern period, those things were all meshed together. They're all part of people's worldview. And it seemed very natural for those things to inform one another in a way that it doesn't now. I mean, we have this notion of separate spheres of politics and religion. But for early modern colonizers, that world would have seemed very foreign and very strange to them. And so, you know, when you're taught that sodomy is bad, you then go about crafting laws that will police people's behavior and structure society in a way that punishes people quite severely. If you're accused of such behavior or you're caught seemingly in engaging in those types of behaviors.
Okay, so let's talk about, I only want to hone in on one tribe that you talk about, and that is it Zuni you pronounce it?
Yes, the Zuni.
Yeah. Why are they particularly a challenge for the USA when it comes to gender identity and gender roles?
Well, part of the reason for this is that in the late 19th century, and this goes back to the English as well, English anthropologists were perfecting the study of field work, field anthropology, and they were going off into the Pacific, into the islands, to Australia, New Zealand, and these sorts of places. And they were, rather than like these sort of old school ethnologies of the 18th and early 19th century relying on travel writing, which is so riven with mistakes, and sometimes people were armchair travel writers. I mean, they didn't leave their fireplace in you know, in London, and would write about native culture as though they had witnessed it. And so English anthropology changes that and begins this tradition of field work. And so this becomes very popular among American anthropologists as anthropology is professionalized at the end of the 19th century. And so you have people like Franz Boas and other famous anthropologists from the era going off and conducting fieldwork, living with native communities for their summer, for example, when they're not teaching. And the plains was, all of the plains and the American West, Pacific Northwest and California, was seen as particularly attractive places for this type of anthropological field work because the assumption was that those were communities, native communities that were untouched, still pure in their indigenous cultures and knowledge systems. So underlying this is this racist notion that Western culture has poisoned the Indianness out of people like the Cherokees, for example, or the Creek Indians and the Choctaw back east, because of their exposure and Western culture being so strong and powerful that it's sort of just, you know, there's no real Indians left back east. And besides which, most have been relocated during the removal era and the Trail of Tears in the 1830s to Indian territory, which is now eastern Oklahoma. So the plains and the Pacific coast were seen as this sort of ideal laboratory of the final surviving fragments of real Indian culture. And the Zuni were one of those, were deemed as most very attractive for anthropologists who bought this sort of so-called doom race theory. And so they would go into Zuni communities, which continued, I mean, still fairly isolated in the Southwest from Western culture, although it's not like they didn't have contact and trade with Western culture, but still from a stereotypical Western anthropological perspective, this was a gold mine of anthropological information, and we need to preserve it before it's gone. And so one of the Zunis who proved to be particularly influential in this anthropological writing was an individual by the name of Wiwa. And Wiwa was a Lahamana and brought, you know, fits under the umbrella term of Two-Spirit, but a Lahamana was someone who took on the roles of a woman. Right. So Wiwa was born biologically male, stood around 6 foot, and was beloved within the Zuni community, was an educator, was a teacher, cared for children in need, was also artistic and a wonderful storyteller and a wonderful mediator. Among the Zuni, but also as I talk about in the book, Wiwa makes a trip to Washington, D.C. with one of his patrons. I won't give all of it away, but that trip to Washington, D.C. sort of seals the legend of Wiwa and the role of the Lahamana and sort of the mysteries of the Zuni. In the minds of Anglo-Americans, of white Americans. The reason then, and there's two parts to this that I think it's important for listeners to sort of think about and reflect on. I mean, on one hand, here we have a Two-Spirit person in the form of Wiwa who's able to negotiate and mediate with Zunis and Americans, right? So this is a sort of powerful form of continuing a traditional role of leader and knowledge keeper that Lahamanas take on in Zuni society. At the same time, those stories are then spun and interpreted in American popular culture and in the media in ways that grossly misrepresent and stereotype Wiwa and Zuni culture. And in fact, Americans were so tied up with and beholden to this whole notion of doomed race theory that they thought that this was probably going to be the end of the line and Wiwa would be the last Lahamana. That wasn't the case, right? So, you know, there are historical lessons in the story of the Zuni on multiple levels for both Zuni people, but also for Anglo-Americans and how colonialism continued to misrepresent the words, actions, and deeds of Two-Spirit people.
And you talk about a reawakening from the 1950s. What actually caused that, do you feel? And how much resistance was there to it, bearing in mind that, you know, 50s USA was not a particularly harmonious society anyway, with concerns about things like communism. So, you know, this reawakening I'm guessing, would have generated some kind of pushback.
Yeah. I mean, in the 50s and 60s, it was a pretty lonely world to be if you were what we call today two-spirit. And a lot, I mean, you know, people understood that that there was something special and different about them. And but for the most part, in terms of public expression and reclaiming that publicly, for most Indigenous people, it was kept either to themselves or to their closest friends. It's really not until the 1970s. I mean, and this springs out of sort of the American Indian movement and the counterculture and all of that stuff in the late 60s and then into the early 70s. And you have a lot of Native gay and lesbian people moving to places like Seattle and San Francisco for college. And they get swept up in the American Indian movement and the fervor of the time that sort of, I would say it's optimism for the time that they can take control of the historical narrative and change history's course. And so you have a group emerge in San Francisco, for example, called the Gay American Indians, GAI. GAI is led by, or is founded, I should say, by Barbara Cameron and Randy Burns. And Barbara passed away several years ago. Randy is still alive and still very active in the community in San Francisco. But that was an example of Native people trying to reclaim. They were searching, grasping for the traditions that would give their identities meaning. And they were doing it in an urban context, though. And I think that's important because what you had in the mid-20th century were federal government policies designed to terminate Indian nations, what was referred to as termination. They weren't subtle about it. And there were programs to relocate, kind of a second removal, a second trail of tears, if you will, Native people to urban areas, cities like San Francisco, Oakland, Los Angeles. And that was part of the termination program to break up Native communities, to end sovereign communities. And so, you know, out of that, though, comes this desire to reconnect diasporically with tradition. And because urban areas, cities like San Francisco, become such hubs for gay and lesbian politics in the late 20th century, people we know today as Two-Spirit were attracted to these parts of America. But once they got there, what they found is they were locked out of LGBT communities. There was intense racism within those communities. And so they had to form their own societies and communities to nurture a sense of not only safety, but solidarity, companionship, and to begin some sort of political movement that would eventually emerge in the late 80s and into the 1990s and become known as Two-Spirit. So there's much more to the story, but that's the sort of the genesis of this sort of modern resurgence in Two-Spirit identity. And now talking multiple generations of people who have taken the story and are driving the narrative and are redirecting the course of Two-Spirit history in very creative and innovative ways.
Have to ask, in terms of the wider treatment of Native Americans across history, can you put this in the context for us? In terms of the wider treatment of the Native Americans across history, where does this fit in? Can you set this within the context of the wider oppression of the communities for our listeners?
Yeah, I think this sits at the center of efforts to engage in genocidal behaviors. In terms of situating it within the context of settler colonialism, because people have to keep in mind that genocide is not just about the physical destruction of a people. It's that and more. And we see that throughout the Americas. And in fact, in coming up with that term genocide, I mean, that was what Raphael Lemkin was identified, was the treatment of indigenous peoples language, culture, political, and knowledge systems. And when you think about how from a very, very early period, there was this desire to eradicate native languages, to disrupt indigenous cultures, to separate people from their political structures, their kinship structures, then you're talking about a multi-level effort to dismantle indigenous history, culture, and society. And thinking about that and thinking about the central role that Two-Spirit people play in those communities, in many of those communities, not all, but you know, many, well over 150, what would today be federally recognized Native communities, then you sort of get a sense of why Europeans targeted certain leaders for some very violent and vile attention. It's because they were the ones who were holding these communities together and were passing on the knowledge to the next generations. So I think that's really important to wrap our heads around in terms of context. I mean, there's a lot of forethought here then going on the part of colonizers in trying to weaken and destabilize Native communities by targeting people we identify today as Two-Spirit. And I think that's important. The other thing, briefly, I think that's important to sort of think about is the manner in which Two-Spirit people were able to sort of adapt and innovate and work around that over time. I think that even though we're talking about some very sort of sad and violent episodes, we are, when we come out of this at the end of the day, we're talking also about a story of resilience and innovation and adaptation that keeps living traditions and knowledge alive. And thank God for those people who had the foresight to resist in various ways, because it's made this current generation of reclaiming possible.
I've got one final question, if I can, to wrap up what's been such an interesting episode. And it's about the future. Big question, obviously, speculative. But is there reason for optimism for the Native American community in reestablishing their identity in all senses of the term, but particularly in relation to Two-Spirit?
You know, I spend a lot of time talking with Native people, and I spend a lot of time in Native communities, particularly the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indian, where I'm currently working on a project related to rivers and water in Cherokee history. And the sense I get is, yes, there is optimism and there is hope, but it's cautious optimism and hope, because there's a recognition that Native people in the United States and Canada still live in colonized spaces, and they still have to navigate a world in which settler colonial governments define the parameters of what is, I won't necessarily say possible, but what is normative in the world in which we live, right? And so there is a cautious optimism. There's also a recognition, though, that there are very real challenges, right? We're facing in the United States, for example, at the moment, an extraordinary attack on transgender people. State lawmakers throughout the country are passing laws that target transgender people. You might have seen in Texas this past month, in March, an effort on the part of the governor to have parents up on child abuse charges if their child was receiving treatment for being transgender. You have in Florida a piece of legislation that has passed.
This one I've heard about. It's horrible.
It's horrible. It's popularly known as the Don't Say Gay Bill.
Yeah.
And there's a piece of legislation in my home state of Canada. There's a bill currently that will do something very similar if it is signed by the governor.
This Don't Say Gay Bill prevents any school from mentioning homosexuality or transgender to 10 years old and under.
That's right. And but it's framed in such a nefarious way that those with power on school boards can define what is and is not sexually appropriate. That it empowers them to sort of take texts and curricula out of the system, material that would provide information and inform, you know, decision making as young people become adults. Children, young adults will be left in the dark, right? Now, it's not as though small children are being exposed to sort of, you know, graphic sexual pornographic material as it's often made out to be. I mean, it's age appropriate material.
I mean, they're not being provided with a list of alternative lifestyles either, are they?
No. What is being, I think what some people are upset about on the political spectrum is that there's been an effort on the part of educators and historians to engender a sense of radical empathy. And it's radical in the sense that we've been telling histories that previous generations of white male historians haven't been willing to tell, right? So they've been telling stories about royal families and political leaders and, you know, the great men of history type narratives. And one of the things that is fabulous about the historical profession is it has attracted such a diverse range of people who have improved the way in which we tell history and write about history. Men, women from all racial and ethnic backgrounds, men and women from different political perspectives, people from different gendered and sexual identities. It's become a very diverse profession. And I think that has unstabilized the sense of certainty that some people feel was once present in a world that seems to be changing very fast around them, right? So I think one of the things then, I mean, I will say one, my book probably won't be approved by school boards around the country because it does challenge that sense of male, female certainty and the gender binary. I'll get myself in trouble here, but it is the case that the genie has been let out of the bottle in terms of the history is out there, and we have to deal with the complexity of historical knowledge and life, and putting that genie back in the bottle, I think, is going to cause far more emotional and political distress than anything else. I'll leave it there.
It's a thought for us to end on. I hope you don't get in trouble for that.
Oh, I'm used to it. Don't worry about it.
I love the idea that somewhere out there, there's a whole bunch of straight white men, probably middle-aged and above, just losing their shit because they're no longer the center of the universe, and long may it continue.
I love that too.
What a pity. No doubt they'll write an angry letter to, I don't know, Daily Mail or something. This has been brilliant, Craig. Thank you so much for joining us. Reclaiming Two Spirits, Sexuality, Spiritual Renewal and Sovereignty in Native America. It is out, folks. You can get it from the History Hack bookstore. Check the link in the description. That'll take you through to our link tree where you'll be able to see the bookstore and you'll be able to buy it. And if you buy through that link, rather than all the profits going to Jeff Bezos to fund his rocket fuel, the author gets a cut. Yes, you've heard this rant before. I don't care. I'm going to do it every single time until you're sick of it and run away screaming. But also, if you buy through the bookstore, we also get a little bit as well. So you're supporting two individuals who massively appreciate it. It's been brilliant, Greg. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
It's brilliant. Can I just say as well that Two Spirits is such a lovely term, a lovely positive term. And I quite like it.
I like it too. And I was just going to say, it's a term that folks are debating within the Two Spirit community, because there are other terms that have emerged, as you saw in the book, like indigiqueer.
That just sounds faddy. I like Two Spirits.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it sounds very jargony. But yeah, I mean, it's the way Two Spirits being used as a verb is something very active. I think that that's really beautiful. So, yeah.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.